welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you very, very much for joining us today. These podcasts, as you know, are involved in exploring issues related to our own aging, the implications of longevity on our families and our communities. And again, we welcome your suggestions and comments. You can email them to me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And it is a pleasure to welcome back for a return visit, encore presentation, Rabbi Shmuley Yanklowitz from beautiful Arizona, founder and president of Yat Home. Shmuley was here last year, I think, on one of his, the Pirkei Avot book on social justice. Today, we're going to talk about this creation of Rabbi Yanklowitz's Yat Home, the Jewish Foster and Adoption Network, which in truth is another aspect of social justice. So first of all, Shmuley, todah rabah, baruch haba, thank you for joining us. I'm fascinated to learn about Yat Home. You created this, so the obvious first question is, why?
Awesome, Rabbi. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me back. It's a delight to be with you, as always, on your amazing podcast.
Thank you.
And this is an issue very close to my heart, so... So thank you so much for the opportunity to engage with you on this. You know, I care about a lot of issues, as we all do, but really when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, I got clarity that my number one issue that kept me up at night was vulnerable children who experience abuse and neglect. I just can't fathom living in the body and mind of an infant or a young child or an older child who is experiencing such a reality. And I asked myself, well, how Jewish is this? I don't see a lot of Jewish work on it. And I looked at the Torah, and the Torah over and over talks about the Yat Home, the vulnerable child. And it was clear to me how much of a priority it was, in addition to being a human value, being a Jewish value. And I saw that there were major gaps in the American Jewish community of what was being offered and the type of support that was there, and thought we might have an opportunity to make an impact.
So let's clear up something right away. Walk me through quickly adoption in the Torah, because, you know, people say, well, you know, we have all these stories and everything, but yet adoption is there, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yes, it very much is there. And sometimes we translate the word yatom as orphan, but I don't translate it as orphan. I translate it much more broadly as vulnerable child, because, of course, foster children are not orphans. There's very many different definitions of orphans. Some say if both parents have died. Some say if a mother has died. Some say if a father has died. But there doesn't have to be a death for a child to be incredibly vulnerable, and for there, in my view, to be a mitzvah for us to support them. And so adoption, as we know it, is a modern idea in regards to the type of legal framework we think of engaging in. But the idea is ancient at its core, the idea that a new family or individual will take responsibility for raising a child. And we're in our holiday season now, with Purim coming up, where Mordechai adopts Esther, and Pesach, where Moshe, of course, is adopted. We have many sages in the Talmud who themselves are either foster children or adopted, however we want to view that. And this is viewed as a huge mitzvah, however we define mitzvah, as a great thing to do, to not only provide the sustenance, the home, but the emotional support and the love and the spiritual guidance.
So Yeah, Tom, if somebody is listening to this or watching this and they're touched and they want to get in touch with you, what's the website? How do they contact you?
Great. Yatom.org, Yatom.org, or yatom613@gmail.com would be an email, or we have a Facebook group, a page. And so it would be easy to get in touch with us. And there's many opportunities of ways to participate.
So let's start from the very beginning. And as we were talking before, I don't know a colleague in a congregation in many organizations who has not dealt with this in some way, shape, or form in their professional and, in many cases, personal life. Walk me through the process. Somebody may be listening to this. This is something I'd like to get more information. We either don't have a child. We want to adopt a child and add to our family. What's the process? You know, there's all kinds of mythologies. The foreign adoption is closed. What do we do about this? How long does it take? Walk me through the process here.
Okay, amazing, amazing. Yeah, there's so many different paths. And to be sure, this path is open to so many. Well, I'm always inspired by the diversity of applicants we get to our fellowship program, for example. Everyone thinks of this as kind of a 40-year-old couple, but actually the ages vary. I have been in homes of couples in their 70s who are fostering. Obviously, there are many single mothers who engage in this work. Gay couples, I mean, a whole range of individuals, couples, ages that participate. And there's so many ways to participate. It is true that international adoption is not the easy pathway it once was. It used to be, I remember hearing so many stories that if you just filled out the paperwork 3 months later, you know, in Russia or in Haiti or in China, you were getting a phone call and a month later flying, and international adoption was an easy pathway towards family building and supporting children. That obviously has changed in many ways. When my wife and I were a part 10 years ago, seeking international adoption, we were far along in the Russia process, and a child was presented to us, and that was when Russia closed its doors. I mean, right. Russia's in the news a lot right now. Hopefully, whenever this is listened to, things have gotten better, not worse.
I hope so.
but it's very scary. And this was right at the moment where Russia closed its doors to adoption for the U.S. And for many reasons, things have changed in international. Then there's private adoption, where you work with an attorney and somebody wants an infant and arranges this with the bio mother. But I think the work we're most involved with tends to be fostering or foster to adopt. Fostering mean one has no intent to adopt. They may be for it, they may not be for it, but ultimately they are merely supporting whatever the case plan is. And foster to adopt meaning one is open to and even inclined towards adoption and views their foster care, views their fostering as the pathway.
Talk to me, you use the term, and even on the website, of vulnerable children. One can assume that all children, especially infant, are vulnerable, but do you have a different take, a definition, or a broadband on what that word means specifically for Yatom?
Yes. Thank you so much for asking. Because I do believe very deeply that we are all vulnerable, not only because of our mortality how easy it is to be sick, how easy it is to die, how easy it is to be ashamed, how easy it is to have loss. So vulnerability is obviously a central theme with all humanity, and most definitely, as you pointed out, with children who don't necessarily have the tools yet to navigate typical vulnerability. But I think the type we're referring to here are those who have lost their most basic infrastructure for survival, those who have lost either a caregiver or basic safety or security in their home, either because of abuse or because of neglect or because of a death, that they basically are not safe in their natural home of origin.
Shmuley, how do you connect with these children? Are you part of a national organization? You just can't go to Target. I mean, how do you, I want to enter this process. How do you make that match? What's on the other end?
Okay, great. So we operate outside of the system. We are not an adoption agency. We do not engage in placements. We operate as kind of a middle person, in between the individuals and the system at large. And so to look at our three biggest efforts, our biggest effort is our family fellowship program, where individuals or couples come to us and we want to incentivize them and support them to start this journey that they've been wanting to start. They say, I've been wanting to foster for years or adopt for years. I just have some barriers. And we did some research and we found those three barriers most typically were financial, education, just knowing what to do, and community. They felt alone. So we built a fellowship responding to those three, giving a stipend to them, giving, holding their hands through an educational process of how to navigate the system. And thirdly, a micro community to kind of think and process with. And so that we prepare them in their certification and licensing process and support them in their journey. Our second program is micro grants that we give to families who already are immersed in adopting or fostering, where we help to financially support them, those who are want to quit because it's just so taxing on them, and we keep them in. And our third is in the realm of advocacy and general education. And so, yes, there are some cases where there are unique children that come to our attention, and where we do advocate for their placement, but generally we're not involved in specific cases like that.
So you also on the website on your advocacy thing, and I think this is something that a lot of people may not be aware of. You call for an advocacy of bipartisan adoption tax credit. Could you translate that into New Jersey, and what does that mean?
Absolutely. Yes. So I think one of our main areas of advocacy is around LGBTQ plus inclusion. Another important issue emerging now. I just had a conversation with, you may have heard of this couple in Tennessee recently who was barred from fostering because they were Jewish. And so there is right. faith discrimination also in addition to other forms of discrimination. But yes, also this adoption tax credit is very important to us because it essentially makes family building possible for those who have financial struggles or not totally financial comfortable, that the adoption tax credit is a form of assistance, of a tax break for those who have large expenditures based upon their fostering, based upon their adoption journey.
So I think it's important to understand that people don't get a misapprehension that Yatom is not an adoption placement service, correct?
Right.
If correct. I call you and register with you, you are not going to then turn around and 5 months later, after all the things are done, right. say, here is an opportunity for you to have a child. You don't do that. Right. You're an educational advocacy support network to say, we're going to help you through the process, correct?
Right.
State by state. So now there's different laws in different states.
Right. That's right.
And what about international? For somebody who's listening to this in Winnipeg, you do stuff, you help individuals and couples outside the United States.
It's funny you mentioned Winnipeg. I know that was just a random.
It was random.
But literally last week, the head of JFCS of Winnipeg reached out to talk about their foster and adoption work and possible partnership. And so it was such an amazing random example.
It's been shared.
But yes, we are focused on supporting American Jews at this time. We are not equipped to navigate the Canadian system or Europe or Israel. Although we do hope to get to that point. But we do most certainly support families or individuals in their international adoption process who are based here in the States.
Now, you mentioned partners with JFCS in Winnipeg, but the broad network of Jewish Family and Children's Services across the United States, some of whom are like where we are here in southern New Jersey, Marla Myers organization, very, very powerful, unbelievable organization. And I know across the country. How do you partner with, let's say, the JFCS in Phoenix or LA or Southern New Jersey? How does that work?
We actually don't have any formal partnerships in place there. We're playing a different role than any of them are. And so we do hope, and actually there are some conversations now of starting some kind of umbrella group that anyone who's involved or interested in this can have a place where the leaders can kind of talk and potentially partner. But this is all pretty new. I mean, as you mentioned, for decades, this has been a conversation.
Right.
But actually building the infrastructure to properly, I mean, we can't even respond to a fraction of the requests we get. The number of people who want to participate, who either need a grant or want to join our fellowship program or need guidance. And they don't know where to turn. And the truth is, most JFCSs are not even engaged in this.
Correct.
In this work. There are those that are heavily involved, but some, it's just too big.
No, I think that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's a perception a lot of times as I do stuff around the country. Well, you know, if there's a JFCS and there's not in every town, then that's the place to call. And they'll come and say, no, we're out of the adoption business. We've been out of the adoption business for decades.
Yes.
It's important for people to understand that, you know, you are one of those resources that can help guide and support. We have a lot of, obviously, in Jewish sacred aging, a lot of people over the age of 50. Okay. And you alluded to at the beginning that you've actually sat in couples in their 70s about fostering. Talk to me a little bit about if somebody, let's say, is in their 60s or 70s and they're healthy, you're young and vibrant, as many of our contemporaries are. They say, this is something that we can give back. We can give back something to the community. Talk to me about age discrimination and barriers to somebody's, you know, that they may encounter as somebody that's, say, 65 years old as opposed to 35 years old.
Great. Awesome. So in terms of fostering, there would not be any barriers. I know so many.
It's interesting.
I know so many folks. In fact, some of my heroes are folks in their 80s and 90s who have fostered like hundreds of kids and are still going. I don't know how they do it. But in the adoption realm, most certainly there would be those who, you know, I think that when there's a selection process, the system will skew towards younger parents. But there are so many ways to participate in this. Obviously, like every cause, there's always financial support. But beyond that, there is the realm of advocacy and entering the education realm. Then there's supplies. There is such a need for supplies, whether it's diapers or cribs or clothes or bikes, to organize drives. And then beyond that, I think we want to see a Jewish communal system change where our community does not yet know how to support these families in our community. I mean, some communities do, of course, but by and large, they don't. That, for example, when we had a baby born in our family, a biological child, people would reach out. Can we make you a meal? How can we support? When a new foster child would emerge, in many ways, just as difficult of a transition, some ways harder, aside from my wife's recovery, which wasn't there, you know, people don't reach out. In fact, they do the opposite of support, where they grill you with questions, by and large. Oh, what's the child's background? Was there drugs involved? What's the abuse? Say, whoa, this is like, this is not public information. There's the rights of privacy to the children and to the family. And so we need not only communities to support when families are taking this on, but also to provide respite. One thing that that seniors might do if it would be way too much to fully adopt or foster is provide respite. One can provide respite for a few days or for a week or for 2 weeks and be certified as someone who can give a break. As a foster parent, it is so exhausting. If someone had said, could we support you for a day where the child will take the child to a theme park or the park, you know, it would be such a relief. You know, so there are many avenues to get involved beyond checking the box to fully sign up.
Shmuley, you allude to something very interesting. Let me ask you, why the difference in approach between, yes, we've just adopted this brand new little baby, as opposed to, yes, we're just taking in, we're fostering this 8-year-old. Why is the hesitance on one, you know, okay, as opposed to, let's do the bris, let's have wonderful, et cetera, et cetera. What's going on there?
Oh, so I just want to be sure I understood the question. Was this about the age discrimination issue?
Well, it's when you alluded to the fact that people react to somebody having a foster child much different than adopting.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I see. Okay. Yes. Yes. So I think that there's such an intrigue. People are so oftentimes uneducated or prepared to understand how foster care works or how adoption works that they're not aware of how difficult it is when they grill an adoptive parent about, you know, all of a sudden they see the first Black child in their synagogue or their first Chinese child in a synagogue, and they have so many questions and they feel it's appropriate to to kind of grill the family. Obviously, with a birth child, there's not so many, you know, open questions of unpredictability. And so as part of the Jewish nature of of grilling people, who are you? Where are you from? Who do you know? You know, and so we're used to doing that. But it can be sensitive here. And I think that we should try to follow the lead of the foster parent or the adoptive parent on kind of sharing information.
Julie, is there an average length of time that a person or a couple fosters a child? I mean,
Oh, boy, I wish there was. I mean, obviously, mathematically, there is. But just to share my own experience, some children came into our home for a day or a week.
Wow.
And some came for over a year. And it goes beyond that. Some children will be literally years in a court process. And one of the reasons for that, and this is very frustrating for people who are in the foster to adopt process, because the total unpredictability and the bureaucratic nature of the system, not only is everything just slow, that understandably, the foster care system is geared towards reunification as the primary goal. Reunification with biological family is generally the idea of what we want to support. And that's because there used to be an orphanage system. And right. That orphanage system in America went out of, expired, closed, and morphed into the foster care system. As opposed to putting children in institutions, we put children in homes with the goal not primarily of adoption, but the goal primarily of reunification. And so when a biological parent has engaged in abuse or neglect of a child, the system wants to give them the chance to correct that. And sometimes they'll be given, based on the severity, a month, or 3 months, or 6 months, or a year. And then sometimes the clock resets. So there's a year and there's no progress. And right before that court date, the bio mother shows up and says, oh, I just got a job and I'm taking this course and I'm going to, so they say, okay, let's give you another 6 months. And then they find she's in a drug rehab again and whatever the case is. But she shows up at court, they give her another 6 months. And so to be honest, even though I support the reunification goal, the most challenging part of being a foster parent for us was often when we felt the judge decided too soon to send the child back. We felt, geez, this biological family, we support getting there, but they're all they've shown is that they've been off drugs for a few months. There's no job. There's no home stability. There's no clear indication there won't be more abuse or neglect. The children who are now thriving with us, the idea of them going back is terrifying. And sadly, some of those kids went back to those homes and then ended up back in foster care system. And in some cases, back in our home again.
Are you finding in the work that you're doing with Yatom, the Jewish Foster and Adoption Network? And again, we're talking with Rabbi Shmuley Yankelevich, the founder and president of Yatom. Given the changes in society, a greater acceptance or willingness to foster interracial children, LGBTQ kids, have you seen a greater acceptance of this?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there's so much happening on this front right now, and there's those in the ideological camp. Everyone agrees that you have to do all you can to maintain the culture and stability of the foster child. And that becomes complicated in interfaith homes. In the sense that if you're a Jewish home and you bring in a Christian child or a Muslim child or whatever the case is, or vice versa, how do you maintain your own home norms and include them without pushing it on them, while also maintaining their cultural or religious norms without having them feel like a second-class citizen? And so it can oftentimes be very challenging. It's one of the most common issues that we support our families in. And one ideology says we should particularly find foster families that are aligned with the ideology or the religion or the culture the child's from. So a Black child should primarily go to a Black home, and a Jewish child in a Jewish home. And there's those that say, no, it doesn't matter. As long as a family is safe and licensed, anyone can go anywhere. And so there's a range of views on this. And it is kind of complicated. And one of the cases that emerges consistently is Jewish children who are lost in the system, who ultimately end up in foster care in a non-Jewish home and then end up being adopted outside of the Jewish community, which, you know, is a source of sensitivity towards Jews and continuity. Right. And then there's the multiracial issues of, where do we want a child of color ultimately to be adopted? And what's ultimately best for their future? And it's really kind of a fierce debate around this point.
You mentioned something about licensing. If I want to be a foster family, is there a licensing? Do I have to go through some hoops? Do I have to fill out forms? I just can't just call you up and say, yes, I this is what we want to do.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
So it is actually a little bit of a grueling process. And so one does have to kind of decide that, you know, they're committed to getting through it. Because if sometimes we'll post, this Jewish parents just died. There's four children. Is someone prepared to take them in? And people raise their hand, but we say, listen, you have to be, generally, licensed to do this. There are some exceptions where something can be sped up for various reasons, especially if it's family. I think the paperwork is not so difficult. I think the two most difficult aspects, one is the home being inspected, that there's many safety protocol in a home that you really sometimes have to overturn your home and how it's set up to be set up properly. But the bigger one is coursework. There's a lot of coursework that has to be done, which may feel like 101 to someone who's been a parent already. But really kind of jumping through a lot of hoops around training, which understandably is important, so someone understands the sensitivities. So yes, there is a process, and then maintaining that license is also a certain amount of work also. Once home becomes like a property of the state where they're constantly coming in and reviewing and checking things out, understandably, because sadly, there's also abuse and neglect that happens in foster homes. And so it's very important that they are checking that out, but it's also very taxing on those foster parents.
What's the greatest gift that one of these children can give a foster family?
Oh, wow. Wow. I think the greatest gift they can give is their ability to thrive. When a child enters our home and they can't sleep in the dark because of their trauma, they're malnourished because they weren't fed, they are afraid of hugs or of any form of care. They have severe learning disabilities that are not just natural, but are due to not having been supported. They have delays. And then starting to see their resiliency of how they grow and adapt, I think is such an enormous gift. Their ability to open their hearts to these families who they don't even know. Is just amazing. So I think those are the two things, their own growth and their own capacity for love that is just remarkable.
Well, I thank you for sharing your love and your gift to these families and these children. And Rabbi Shmuley Yanklowitz, the founder and president of Yatom, the Jewish Foster and Adoption Network. Again, Shmuley, if somebody wants to connect with you, the website is what?
Yatom.org, Yatom.org. Thank you so much, Richard. This has been delightful to talk to you.
Listen, you just take care of yourself and good luck. I should plug your new book on kidney surgery, kidney transplant, right?
Thank you very much.
The title of the book is, real fast, title of the book?
A 5-ounce gift.
Published by?
It's a spiritual and medical and ethical guide towards kidney donation. If anyone in your family is struggling with kidney disease and is looking for a donor in the family or out, this can help be a guide to help to navigate that system.
Who publishes it, Shmuley?
That was actually Ben Yehuda Press.
Okay.
But also of relevancy, I just heard this week that I just adore CCAR Press, and CCAR Press this coming summer is putting out my commentary on Sefer Mishlei, the Book of Proverbs. There's been a delay in supplies in the publishing world, and so that's part of the delay. But I'm also really excited about that.
Well, so maybe we'll get you back to talk about both books around the summertime. Hey, Hatzlacha Todah Rabah. Since this is coming up in between Yom Tov and Chag Sameach and Pesach, and just take care of yourself. Thank you very much. Stay safe. Todah Rabah.
You too.
To all of you, again, thank you for joining us on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. And again, if you'd like to connect with us, just email me, rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And if you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help support these podcasts and our work, go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com. Go to the conveniently located donate button, click on that, and just follow the prompts. Secrets of Meaning is produced at the Broadcast Center of Lubetkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And a specific shout out to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Again, thank you for joining us. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. We look forward to greeting you on the next edition of Secrets of Meaning. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, everybody.